For purposes of this gathering, I'm Sarah Naylor, and I'm with the Lutheran Office for Governmental Affairs in Washington, D.C., and the topic of this workshop will be about healthcare in the United States, and we'll be talking some about universal access to healthcare. Okay?
That's just for the taping ministry to be able to know what we're going to talk about. And this time, as a way of getting started, I'd like to engage all of us in some discussion and dialogue about the healthcare system as we know it. And then we'll spend some time, I'll share some facts and figures with you, but I'd like for this to be more of a discussion among us than I've done in the past. So, I have a few questions. One that I'm curious about is whether or not anyone in this room belongs to an HMO, health maintenance organization. Yeah. Okay. And I'm wondering if there's anyone in the room who does not have insurance. Okay. I'm curious to know how many of you in this room feel that your coverage is adequate? Wow.
What's going to happen to us? You can't answer that question without knowing what you're talking about.
Well, that's
about long-term coverage.
I'm curious what I want to know from you is, what do you feel adequate is, you know? Because there are so many people in our country who have inadequate health care coverage. So I'm curious to know from you what that means for you.
Would that be Tim?
Yes, please.
Okay. I happen to be retired from Bell System. Mm-hmm. And I'm covered by Blue Cross Blue Shield. And we have several connections on that if you go into a higher level. And I have known many people who have, and I'm very fortunate, I've never been that ill or anything. I don't think I've been in the hospital in 20 years.
Wow. Good for you.
But the people that tell me that have used it, about all they've ever had to pay when these other things go into effect is $2,000, which I think is very good for open heart or anything like that.
Absolutely. What about Blue Cross Blue Shield? Do you have any kind of long-term, as this person was talking about, any kind of long-term care package as a part of that coverage?
Yes, we do. Nursing homes, so on.
Really? Mm-hmm. Amazing. What about yours?
I don't have long-term. I just have. But mine is very good.
And who is the carrier for yours?
It's MedCenters.
And is it an HMO?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's very good. And then, of course, Medicare.
Okay. Anybody
else? I'm not old enough for Medicare yet. But when I am old enough, I will have this other coverage besides Medicare. And every 3 months, the Bell System will reimburse me for what will be taken out of my Social Security for the Medicare.
That is an excellent plan.
Very good.
By the way, my health costs my employer $4,800 a year. It's a lot of money.
Yes,
yeah,
it is.
It's good, but, you know, it's costing too.
And are you having to contribute to that premium at all?
When I'm 65 next month. But it'll only cost me $85 a month, so that's not a big deal. But then I have to pay for the Medicare, too.
Oh, yeah. That's what mine costs, about that.
Okay.
And then, of course, the Medicare is taken out of, which I can handle right now.
Anybody else? Yes, Ron.
Until about, I guess, 2 or 3 years before I retired, we were concerned about what we were going to do with our health care and so on. And in New Jersey, retired educators solved the problem for us. Their lobby was so strong that they were enabled to enact complete medical assistance for us Blue Cross Blue Shield and Prudential up to 80% for us, for both of us.
But if he dies, then I'm
cut off.
So that was enacted about 6 months before I retired. So we feel very, very fortunate. It was one of those things we were worried about for a long time.
Yes, I should say so.
Does it provide nursing home too?
No.
Yeah, do any of these plans provide for nursing home care of these people? Interesting. So that means then that if your policy, if you require nursing home care, it means that you will need to either spend down, you'll have to spend your assets down to be able to qualify for Medicaid. And Medicare is based on age, so, not age, excuse me, pardon me.
Likelihood of getting better is what Medicare is based on.
Yeah, right. Interesting. Okay. Well, that's interesting because I think I would say, you know, if you think about what your concerns are with the plan that you have, do you have any concerns other than long-term care concerns with the policies that you have? Okay. That tells me a lot then about how you felt about that legislation that was introduced about catastrophic health care that was defeated, fortunately. How many of you wrote letters or responded to that particular piece of legislation?
Why the comment, fortunately?
Primarily because my concern about that piece of legislation, even though it would have provided care for people over the long term, my concern was that persons who were having to pay for it, or the elderly, persons who were probably least able to pay for it.
Are the elderly the least able to pay for it?
Some are,
yeah. Yeah, but that's an assumption in this country that's not necessarily valid.
Okay, how do you feel about
it? Okay, I will grant that the poorest portion of our population are the elderly widows, mm-hmm. but also the richest portion.
Mm-hmm. Keep going.
And why should the next generation pay for health care for somebody who just managed to live to 65? Because that's the alternative. If you're not going to tax the people who are using the benefit to help pay for that benefit, granted you can't pay for it totally, mm-hmm. the system has just cost too darn much. But if they're not going to pay anything for it, why are we asking our children to pay for it?
How do you all feel about that? About what he said? Yeah. Pardon me?
I feel like he does, I think.
Yeah. Well, they should pay some. Maybe they can't pay at all, but they should pay some.
I feel that our country has its priorities mixed up. I don't think there should be anybody in this country, especially the elderly, who should suffer from lack of health care. And if our priorities were straight, that would not be a problem.
Absolutely.
That's my thought. And I, you know, I don't care if they're rich or poor. They should be able to have health care. And we have the resources, we just are using them differently.
And I guess I said fortunately because I am a strong proponent for a universal access system. And my bias is that we would move toward that, which I'm saying it before I get to that next question, because I'm really curious about how you all feel about a system that would provide for universal access to health care for everyone. How do you feel about ensuring that?
But they should also have to pay, you know, a little bit up front.
How does everyone else feel about that?
If they can pay.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody should be denied
medical
attention and care because they can't afford it. To me, that's a sin.
Mm-hmm. Our country is rich enough and our priorities are of something.
Yes.
Should anybody be denied food?
Sure.
Should any baby denied shelter?
No.
Healthcare is one of those benefits, but in fact, in our society, all three of those benefits are denied. There are some real definite problems in our society, and it goes beyond healthcare.
I agree.
Ed, what was the Washington, D.C.'s Commissioner for Health, remember?
Reed Tuckson.
Reed Tuckson. I went to a conference in Atlanta that was sponsored by the Wheat Ridge Foundation and now called Families USA organization that talked about the church's role and healthcare, that brought together about 400 or 500 people across the country to talk about the dilemma of healthcare. And Dr. Reed Tuckson gave one of the presentations, and something he said has really stuck with me, even though I couldn't remember his name for the moment. And that was that it's interesting that you can measure the health of an entire community by the healthcare system that it has in place for its citizens. And that was an amazing insight to me, because I hadn't necessarily thought of healthcare being a barometer for the entire health across the board of a community. Which is basically what you're talking about. And so that says to me then, when I look at a place like Washington, D.C., for instance, which is where I live, and I look at the dilemma of healthcare in that place, where many of the emergency rooms have been closed down or are providing very minimal care. Oh, I'm glad you're back.
Just listening.
Yeah. But where the emergency rooms are either closed down or where there's minimal care being provided for people who have the need to access the healthcare system, but they themselves don't have healthcare coverage. And then I look at all of the other services. I was trying not to use that, but I will use it. We need.
I can go find out.
What are we, right on top of the powder shop, so maybe he's going to see.
But at any rate, you know, a number of services in that particular community are going wanting. And there are many people who don't have access to food or housing or anything. And healthcare is one of those issues that's where people are especially vulnerable. So that was interesting to me. And then when we translate that to rural America, when we lived in Arizona, and I look at that whole situation, it's the same. There are the same issues that are prevalent there and across this country. So I guess I really don't have to do much convincing of you all that we should be looking at a universal access system. Is there anybody here who doesn't know what I'm talking about when I talk about a system of healthcare that would provide universal access to care for everyone? Yay.
But which model do you want to use?
That's right. That's okay.
And who's going to pay for it?
That's right. That's the primary issue. Let me tell you that a number of us in Washington have been talking about universal access to health care, and we have this working group that meets every Monday, and we've been doing this now for about 3 months, trying to look at how the various faith groups and denominations have developed policy statements over the years that would address the whole issue of healthcare. And our goal is to develop a national campaign that will encompass all the work of all of our various denominations and will allow us then to speak to Congress primarily with one voice. But the thing that we understand is that in the States, many of you all have been involved in the development of healthcare systems and addressing the issue of universal access now for quite some time. So before I start talking about what we're doing in Washington, I would be interested in knowing what's going on in the places where you live related to universal access to healthcare.
I don't know the details of this, but I do know in Washington State there is some access for people with kidney dialysis. If the government provides some kind of assurance that will not be cut off from people to whom it's necessary. Now, I don't know how it's paid, and I don't know enough details about it. I just know two people who have received that benefit where they know they can receive their dialysis three times a week, and what's involved in that, I don't know. But at least it's, the access is there for them when that's a very necessary part of their living.
That's Medicare coverage for kidney dialysis. It's a few years old, and that's national. Any dialysis patient basically is covered by Medicare.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you know whether or not, in the Lutheran Church, there are a number of state public policy offices. There are 17 across the country, and there happens to be one in the state of Washington. And so I've been in contact with the director for the state of Washington and heard about some legislation that is being proposed. I don't know whether or not it's been introduced or not yet, that would address the issue of universal access for the state of Washington.
It was not introduced in the last round of the legislature in Washington.
Okay.
As far as universal access in Washington State, there is no cohesive plan for it. It is not really actually being done yet. In rural Washington, it's a mixed bag. If the physicians accept Medicaid, which they are not required to do, you've got a pretty good system. In big cities, again, the hospital ER becomes the doctor's office because the hospital is forced to accept Medicaid, and the concomitant problems with that. In the rural communities, if the doctor does not accept Medicaid, usually the community puts enough pressure on the doctor to say that no patients die, but nothing much better than that happens.
So there's really no base plan, is that what you're saying?
Not in existence now.
Is that, and that's part of what that proposed legislation would facilitate?
That was a conceptual framework that a number of groups bought off on, but it never got to the stage of any legislator being willing to propose it. Mm-hmm. The state just went through a round of regulation, and a year or 2 years ago, would have deregulated the hospital industry and is now looking at the costs of healthcare, both from the Medicaid side and for the cost that for what the state's paying out for its own employees. And they're dealing right now with the finance aspect. There are a number of items in existing law that regard to access, but there's no cohesive plan for universal access in the state.
Interesting. Are you a physician?
No, I'm a hospital administrator.
Yay, I'm glad you're here. Good.
I can outline three programs that are taking place that were proposed in Minnesota in the last several years to address a variety of these issues that you've raised. Mm-hmm. One of the issues we have is about the people having a hard time to afford or obtain health insurance, and the largest segment of Minnesota that group are the rural family farmers. They don't have an employed group that buys them insurance. They have to get insurance on their own for themselves and their families, often at a cost of many hundreds of dollars per month, and sometimes can't even find those individual policies to purchase. And that's a tough group. For that, a group of rural physicians and one of the larger clinics in central Minnesota actually developed a program they called RAMS, Rural Emergency Medical Service.
They call it what?
RAMS, R-E-M-S.
Okay.
And the purpose of that really was to form a coalition of clinics, physicians, and hospitals that basically provide below-cost health care to these particular people with certain stipulations. Their wellness care was covered, in-clinic care was covered, and necessary operations were covered, but of course elective things, plastic surgery and kind of after things were not covered. And that program was very successful over a four-year span. Actually, it was just resolved several months ago because the farm crisis in our particular state has dramatically been ameliorated. It's not as tough as it was, and if we were finding people weren't applying for those funds anymore. So that particular program only covered a 15-county central Minnesota area, but it was a model program, and the people developing it did sort of travel around the nation at request various times to talk about that program. Another program...
Let me just stop you one second. Are you saying that the farm crisis isn't as dramatic in Minnesota anymore?
That's correct. It's improved considerably.
Great.
Wow.
It rained.
Yeah. It rained, that's one thing.
It rained,
and some interest rates came down somewhat, and land prices went up somewhat, and they had a couple reasonably good harvests. I mean, I think it did improve. There are farms on the auction block every week by the dozen, as they were for a couple of years.
Yeah.
The second program was focused at helping those senior citizens in Minnesota that just couldn't afford they couldn't really afford the difference between the small amount that Medicare pays and what their actual cost would be. That brings up a larger issue I really would like to touch on, inequities in Medicare reimbursement that most people in the nation aren't even aware of. But basically that program was again a voluntary program under the threat of one legislator really pushing for mandatory assignment as they have in Massachusetts. The physicians again in Minnesota have a voluntary program where they will voluntarily accept seniors to a certain number in their practice, where they will accept Medicare assignment as payment in full for their bills. So that program has been going on for 2 years, and again it's fairly successful, and most people in this, most practitioners in the state do participate in that program. We have had threats that we would have mandatory assignment for Medicare brought through the legislature. That has not been actually proposed, so it hasn't had to be defeated or accepted. We also have had a bill that came forth this past year that was defeated, and that was really a guaranteed universal access bill for Representative Ogren from a small rural community proposed. They said basically companies, all employers would have to provide insurance for all of their employees, period. And for those people that didn't fit in the category where they have an employer that would provide it, they would expand what Medicaid would cover and actually bring that up to bridge the gap. And basically, everyone could get health insurance. Again, when no one had any idea when the bill proposed how it would begun to be paid for, it really didn't ever make it through committee.
Yeah.
So that's what's happening in our state.
That's
right
what's
now.
Happening across the country, I think. Anybody else? Thank you very much, both of you.
Could I just address, just for introductory sake, because I think Medicare is one of our big issues. There is a real problem with Medicare right now that the legislature is trying to address. We spoke a little bit about RDRS the other day. And that's that the amount that the government chooses to pay for services for seniors is different from state to state, county to county, all across the nation, based on historical reasons that I won't go into. The fact of the matter is, although every senior citizen pays the same, is it now $65 or $69 premium for their Medicare Part B insurance all over the country, if you live in Dade County, Florida, and go in for a routine doctor's office visit, the government will pay you $43. And of that $43, most doctors will accept that as payment in full. In Minnesota, for example, the county I live in is the third lowest in the nation in terms of its reimbursement rate, because it didn't charge as much in the years when they were developing the schedules. So for the same service and for the same $69 premium the senior pays, they get $11 from the government for that same service. Mm-hmm. And you calculate this, that's just your basic office visit, but lab tests and surgeries and operations and hospital days is one of the reasons why rural hospitals are closing. It's one of the reasons why physicians are leaving rural practice and why we have our real crunch is in access. We have 200 jobs for family physicians in rural Minnesota that I could place this week. And so when we start talking about Medicare, we have to also look at the inequities from state to state. The government is trying to solve that problem with a new system that rates and adjusts the amount of work, but as this gentleman is giggling, it really the original intent of that has already been diluted by lobbying of higher paid procedurally oriented positions, and by the time it's gradually implemented by 1995, many of us are concerned that the true leavening effect of that legislation will be lost.
Yeah, I agree.
Or it could be worse. You could end up with a national fee scale. Part of the difference between rural and urban fees right now is the difference in the cost of living. It is cheaper to live in the country, by and large.
It's not cheaper to provide the health care in the country.
No.
Well, if you're talking about paying doctors and nurses' salaries, which is the biggest component of health care, personnel salaries would be the component of health care. Yes, it is.
It varies. We're 100 miles out from Minneapolis, and we need to be competitive in salaries for our nursing staff and physicians, or you simply don't have them in your shop.
Yeah, I'm 20 miles from the urban center, and I've got the same problem. I agree that there are some problems. The system, to an extent, does make sense. It needs tweaking.
To say the least.
Needs overhaul.
Yeah, I'd say it needs an overhaul, too. I'm with you. But that's, you know, I'm not in the system as you all are, not serving it. I'm involved bystander.
I'm interested to learn, I guess if you could share with the group, what are some of the initiatives proposed in the
group? Be glad to do that. Well, there have been a number on the plate right now that I'm aware of are about 9. Various proposals, but I'm not going to have to tell you about all of those right now. I'm sure that most of you have heard about the Pepper Commission report, and they have not actually completed their final report, at least when I left last week. The final report had not been released as yet. And the primary problem with that report is that it proposes all kinds of wonderful coverage and care, but there again, in every single one of the proposals that I'm aware of, the dilemma, the question is still who's going to pay for it. Most of the proposals suggest that there would be an employer-employee participation in paying for the premium, paying for the coverage. Some of them propose that extra taxes would be raised to be able to pay for the coverage. Last month, there was an actual bill that was introduced by Congressman Russo that really looks good. It is a comprehensive plan that really is a universal access to health care plan, which has blown my mind because it is really the only one that really does provide for a comprehensive plan. But there again, what he is suggesting and recommending is that that there would be an incredible tax base raised to be able to pay for the coverage in the billions of dollars, and that then what would happen is that people would just pay for it, pay small amounts into the plan each year. But I don't really think, I mean, I can't imagine that that's the way it's going to go at this point, because I think most of us would probably resist that kind of revenue generation for the particular plan. There was a Kennedy-Waxman bill that was introduced. It's been introduced now probably for the last 2 congressional sessions, and it was an employer-employee participation bill. It provided that every single employer would pay for insurance for their employees. It targeted primarily those persons who worked at least 25 hours per week. It would take care of people working between 17 and a half and 25 hours a week, so that people who are working part-time would have access to insurance coverage. The problem, there are a couple of problems. One is that what happens with all of the people who are not working at all? You know, you still have those persons, 37 million people in this country, at least, who have no adequate, have no health insurance. You have 50 million people, at least, who have inadequate coverage. You have 12 million children who have no access to health coverage. So, you know, it doesn't really take care of those millions of people who are really suffering from the system. The other problem with that particular legislation was that I didn't like the the formula that was proposed, which said that persons who were working 17 and a half hours would pay more into the premium than people working 25 hours a week. And when I talked with, I was the lone person among our group who really didn't like this bill. It was amazing. What happened with that is that a lot of the advocates in Washington were very supportive of the bill because they saw that there would be an opportunity for coverage for people. And I was the one who got the formula that was produced. And so I was always saying, there's a problem with this bill, major problem with this bill. At any rate, what has happened with it is that it has rolled over into Senator Riegel's subcommittee. There was a deal cut between Senator Riegel and Senator Kennedy, and some of his issues of involving employers in paying for the insurance has been rolled over into the subcommittee's proposal. And theirs is one that's on the docket at this point that also proposes an employer-employee plan. The other proposal of that I don't want to forget because it's very important is that there would have been a public plan developed. And the public plan would have cared for those persons who would not have been employed or who wouldn't have been able to, say this person at working at 17 and a half hours who would have been required to pay a lot more money than the person working 25 hours had the option of whether or not they wanted to participate in that employer-employee plan. And so they could have opted to sign up for the public plan. And so at any rate, we don't know what will happen with that particular legislation yet. That's a major one that's on the dockets, and Senator Riegel has been a strong proponent of employer-employee plan and the development of a public plan. And what they have proposed basically does not look at universal access to health care quite the same ways that I envision and a number of us envision a universal plan would look like. There are a number of different proposals. I don't really want to go into all of them with you. What I would be curious to know is, what I'm hearing you all say is that you believe that everybody in the country should participate in some way, financially, in a plan. I guess the question that I have is whether or not you all are in favor of a single payer system. How's that for a hot potato? Yes?
Yeah. We're going to end up with it. The question is when.
Do you know what we mean by a single payer system?
It's government.
Is that exactly?
Something like Medicare?
Why don't you?
Well, it's also called socialized medicine by those that don't like it.
That's right.
Basically, there is one big insurance company. You're part of the government or a private corporation. You buy it, so you think that's good or bad. And basically all doctors, hospitals, hopefully nursing homes, home health agencies, everybody involved in health care goes to one source for money. And that source pays. And there are various ways to get to that point. But basically all health care is through one, or all health care finance is through one central payer. Where right now, if you go to see the doctor,
You can have patients that have six different insurances. Arguably, they probably don't need more than two, but you do have patients that have six different insurances. It makes a very inefficient system. It makes a lot of money for insurance companies, which is why it exists. But it's a very inefficient system. The way we get money into the system is very inefficient in this country. The way we spend money in the system is also tremendously inefficient. What we have bought with an inefficient system is a lot of choice. And if you're going to have a more efficient system, you're going to give up some of the choices. And that's kind of where the argument is right now.
Someone said to me the other day when we were talking about this that they had concerns because if we looked at the system that Canada has, for instance, and a lot of people have been making comparisons between our system and the Canadian system, where they basically do have a universal access to healthcare system. Everyone in the country has access to healthcare. Yes.
Since you brought it up, I'm a foreigner.
Yeah.
So to speak.
Welcome.
So to speak. By that I mean I'm an American citizen living in Canada. And I could give you a quick
what
it's like,
that.
Like from the user's point of view.
Please do.
My wife and I are both over 65. We pay no premiums. And if you are younger than 65, the last, that's about 4 years ago, we were 65, we paid about $23 a month for our family of two. If it's a family of more than two, that is with children, it would be a few dollars higher. When we go into a doctor, we present our number, and that's the last that we have to do with the administrative part.
Mm-hmm. Love it.
What about doctor care?
We don't have to wait at all.
Oh.
Okay, but if you're going to have an open heart surgery, you're going to wait. You're going to wait 6 months in BC, and if you're lucky, you'll get sent to the UW to have it done.
You will
in Washington
wait
State
for some operations. That's true.
Yes. There are two CAT scan units in the province of British Columbia. In the city of Bellingham, just across the border, there are three CAT scan units. The size of Vancouver is about 2 million people. Bellingham has under 100,000 people. There are choices that are made, and there are results to those choices.
But you've been pleased with the system thus far for yourself.
Yes, I have.
Yeah.
Do you like the doctors?
They're my choice. And so, and we have picked the doctors that we want to have. We have a family doctor. I've had some back problems, so I've been going to a back specialist as well. And last spring I had about 15 weeks of three times a week therapy. So there is, and you don't have to belong to a plan if it's a cancer problem. Anything that's paid by a separate.
And what about being able to access the system if you have cancer? There's no problem with accessing it
at all. How about choice as far as treatment?
As far as I can tell, we go in and talk to the doctor, and he talks with us, and between us, we say, my back has been a problem for a while, and the doctor asks me, do I want an operation, and he gives me the pluses and the minuses for it. And so far, I've decided not to. That's all I can. The upper mechanism of the system, I'm not as well acquainted with.
Mm-hmm. Anna Marie?
Yeah, another foreigner.
Yeah.
And I think I'm from Germany, and I think the Canadian system or German system is comparable.
Yes.
And it's also like you pay when you're in a family about $150, $200 a month. And you can choose the doctor you want to, and like in a case you described right now, if you also can talk to the doctor, and if you're not satisfied or you want to have another resource for getting a better judgment whether you should go in for the operation or not, you can do this, mm-hmm. no problem. And maybe there's also, if you earn like over a specific sum, you can choose your own insurance company. Otherwise, it's kind of governmental, little insurance companies. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's more private and more governmental. And so I'm very satisfied with the German insurance or healthcare
system, delivery system.
I'm yes. curious, both of you talked about choice, and I was inferring from what you were saying that the loss of choice might somehow also mean the loss of quality of care. Is there any indication that mortality or morbidity rates are any higher in countries that practice socialized medicine than in ours?
We have a higher infant mortality here than we have like in Britain or in Canada.
The United States ranks 22nd in infant mortality in all of the industrialized countries of the world.
That doesn't really speak to the quality of care for those who seek the care, but actually is a statistic reflecting the lack of access to care for
Absolutely.
A substantial portion of the population.
What sort of statistics would show us choice problems?
I'm not sure there are.
There are no fast ones. There is another philosophical issue here, though. I'm a resident of Washington State. Right now, Washington State is approaching a horrendous issue with education, because about 10 years ago, we said the state legislature accepts that education in the state of Washington has to be funded by the state. Well, they haven't been doing a good job of it for the past decade, and a lot of school districts are hurting a lot. Now, do we want to turn health care over to the same kind of organization who can, by their choice, decide not to fund health care? And there has been the comment made that in BC, they have not funded the infrastructure of health care adequately. Chronic problems with the nurses, chronic threats of strikes by the physicians in BC. I mean, I get the BC TV news at least once a week, and they're always talking about this issue in BC. And this is not an issue in Washington State. If you're talking about universal access and a single payer system, you're giving somebody else control of how the system works. Right now, there is no control out of how the healthcare system works. It just
But it's also out of control.
Moves along. Well, yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. If there is no control, it is out of control.
It's totally out.
Or we're buying what we choose to buy.
If you can afford it.
The American people as a whole are choosing to buy the current healthcare system. From an Olympian view, it stinks. From the view of the participants, it may not.
From the view of the person who is affluent enough to be able to afford to influence
Which
the system.
Which is the majority of the American voters.
Voters.
Not voters.
Yes, we're talking about politics again.
Well, a number of people in this country believe that within the next 4 to 5 years, we will have a new system.
Yeah, I heard that 5 years ago, with the same time frame.
But this, you did, however, there were different dynamics operating.
But given Rostenkowski's problem last winter, do you honestly think any senator is going to propose a universal access bill that encourages any kind of increase in taxation and really expect it to pass?
Well, that's an interesting question you pose. However, that doesn't really deal with the issue of the whole of the budget and what's happening financially to this country. And the primary reason that this whole issue is a matter of great public debate and dialogue on the Hill is precisely the issue of money. And that is really what is driving the debate right now. It isn't that people don't have access to care. It isn't that we have 37 million people who don't have health care insurance. It's that by the year 2000, we may not have a Medicare system at all. You know, and so then what happens to people? And that's the crux of the matter. This is 1991. We got 9 years to go. So, or 1990, 10 years to go. And when we look at, you know, I just attended a meeting where I represented the ELCA. Is everyone in the room Lutheran? Are there people who are not? You know, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America? I was at a meeting where a number of various boards of pension people were talking about the issues of health care and how they're going to maintain the health care component of the benefits plan that they all offer. Three denominations went belly up last year. Three of their plans went belly up. Every single one of the rest of them are scared spitless because we're talking about increments of 12 to 15% in the cost of providing that health care plan just for next year, just 1991. We don't have any idea what it's going to be in 1992, but we do know that the cost to provide those plans is going to increase astronomically. So, you know, those are the kinds of issues that are driving the debate. The fact that it cost Chrysler $700 to manufacture a car, $700 per car related to the provision of health care benefits. That is incredible. In Canada, I think it's $251, I read. Incredible difference in the cost to provide health care per automobile.
See, you bring up cost. My insurance runs about $300 a month. Now, if they're going to raise taxes, what's the insurance company going to say? They're going to lower my everything. I mean, the insurance companies are going to fight this tooth and nail.
You got it. That's exactly right. And that's the reason why I want to talk with you about that. Because what is happening right now in Washington, at least, and I don't know what's happening in the various states, is that those lobbies are working very hard to ensure that they have a life. And there are a lot of discussions around, you know, everybody knows that we have to do something about this healthcare system. And what they want is their piece of the pie. So even though we're talking about overhaul to some extent, they're trying to make sure that the overhaul isn't so great that it moves them out of business. So, you know, we start talking about a single payer system, that moves them out of business. Single payer system also, you know, the argument that you've just used is also the argument that they use, the whole issue of competition. I think someone else had their hand raised.
Yes. I'm just going to say, though, I think for us as Christians, the issue is bigger than whether or not our taxes are going to be raised or whether we're going to lose our insurance. And some of us don't have the know-how to know how it can be done, but we feel God calling us to work for doing it. And somebody else has got to be more intelligent than I to figure out these things about how it can be done. But I still think I'm my brother's keeper, and God is calling me. I mean, I happen to be fortunate to have a good job, and I have insurance. But my brothers and sisters in my church don't, and they're poor. So I can't just ignore the problem. And somehow, I think I've got to write to my congressman and tell him, there's got to be a better way.
Absolutely.
Even though my congressman happens to be crazy, who says that you can't save money.
And please don't diminish that response. Please don't think that that response is insignificant, because it is not. It is the best thing that you can do. Can you imagine if we had everybody in this room writing a letter, and everybody else that we are aware of in your congregation, for instance, writing a letter to your congressperson saying that you have some major concerns about this particular system that we have in place right now, and just expressing what it is you think. You don't have to know all the technicalities of the legislation or what's being proposed. All you have to know is what you believe and what you're committed to, and put it on paper. Handwrite it, preferably. Better than typing it, because if you handwrite it, the congressperson knows that it's one of a kind. It came from one person who took the time to write. And when you write that letter, be sure that you ask a question so that you get a response and you can begin to develop some relationship with that person. And they know that you care, and they know that they have to respond rather than sending you a canned letter. Okay, that is really important to do. Okay? Yes.
Is the ELCA, you mentioned a coalition of judicatories getting together. Will we see a sort of statement of
yes.
purpose and some sort of organized way in which congregations can become more politically involved?
Thank you. That is exactly what I'm working on.
You can bring me out.
Yeah. He's not a plant. What is your name? That has been what I've been working on now for the last several months, actually. Actually, since I've been in this job for the last 2.5 years, I work for the entity or the unit of the church that's called Lutheran Office for Governmental Affairs, but my job is a split position. I work half-time for the Division for Social Ministry Organizations, which oversees the agencies and institutions of our church, like nursing homes. Did I tell you this before, that there are that the ELCA owns 24% of all nonprofit nursing home beds in this country? Did you know that?
No.
It's amazing. We own hospitals, we have social service agencies, and so forth. So, at any rate, I am the director for advocacy for that division. The other half of my portfolio relates to the Commission for Church and Society, which is the unit of the church where all advocacy relates. So, I am always connected to that particular unit of the church. So, to answer your question, there will be, and I've been talking with some people about developing probably not a social teaching statement, but a message of concern about the issue of persons, about the issue of people not having access to the healthcare system. And so we hope to get that going within the next couple of months. I'm working with a number of denominations and faith groups, Jewish, Methodists, Presbyterians, Episcopalians, and so forth. We've developed a set of working principles that includes a single-payer system. And I have sent that out, that particular document out, to all of the CEOs or the executives of our agencies and institutions, the bishops, the Conference of Bishops, all of the executive directors of the units of the church, and we haven't sent it out to people in congregations yet for input, but I think that within the next few months that will be happening, because I believe personally that it's really important for me to hear from you all, for us in Washington to hear from all of you, that this isn't just my agenda, but it is my agenda, and because of that, it's been important for me to hear from you and to hear from others in the church. And so, we're headed in the direction that allows everyone to have input into the process.
Would you be recommending specific legislation?
No. We possibly recommending, yes. But that won't happen for a while. The way the process works is as people introduce legislation, we all review it, analyze it. I generally send it out to people. If any of you want to be on my list of people to review any of the legislation that comes out, I would be more than happy to have you on my list. Because I am not an expert. It is my job to be aware of what's going on, but I really want to hear from people who are involved in delivering the programs as well as persons who access it. So that's really basically all of us, but I'm really interested in your input. Then as the legislation's introduced and I send it out and I get your feedback, what happens then is it gives me information to go to members of Congress. Generally, they're staff persons in Washington, is who I work through. And we talk about what people in our church believe, what our biases are, what our concerns are, what aspects of the legislation we have some concerns about, and how we want to see that change. And then we write letters and make telephone calls. And hopefully, in this case, I'm very excited that we are at the front end of this one, even though I'll tell you this discussion's been going on, as you know, and a number of you know, that this discussion's been going on for years. This isn't the beginning of it. But there is a new mood in this country. There are people talking about this issue like they've never talked about it before. And I believe that we are on the brink of something different than what you spoke of 5 years ago. And we will be talking with people, all the various faith groups and denominations will be talking about it, as well as other coalitions outside of churches. You know, you're aware, I'm sure, of labor talking about this. The insurance companies are talking about it. Providers are talking about it. Everybody's talking about it. So there are going to be some changes. You can count on that.
What are the doctors saying?
What are the doctors saying?
I think doctors have realized that for a number of years as well, that changes have been already happening for the last decade. Fairly fast and furious, most of the Medicare area. They'll continue to happen. I'm concerned right now when you ask college students about going into profession, they don't want to be lawyers because lawyers make money, doctors don't make money. I'm concerned that the average debt for a fourth year medical student is $50,000 coming out of medical school right now. I'm concerned that the residency programs in primary care specialties of internal medicine, family practice, pediatrics have gone unfilled throughout the nation while radiology and pathology and neurosurgery and orthopedics are filled to the brim because they make money. So it's no secret that someone going into a profession wants to make a good income, especially if you're trying to offset a $50,000 student loan. But I'm real concerned about the quality of providers. We have the same type of shortage, at least in our part of the country, in nursing care. A tremendous shortage of nurses right now going into nursing care. The country still needs to answer the basic question of how much health care we want as a nation and who wants to buy it. We all are buying it. If we simply say, well, accept higher taxes because everyone should have access to first dollar coverage with no co-pays and let it feel free when we actually access the system, let it feel free, we will pay and it'll be very expensive. I think that I don't think anyone has really the answer yet. I think we all know that some changes will be made. I'm not certain I can identify any one particular social program that's been handled on a single payer system with a government in charge that's truly been a success that you can identify in the history of the country. Yes, maybe someone can teach me. So I'm concerned that that may be the system. I'm interested.
Head Start. One of the most successful.
If anyone is interested in being on our mailing list.
Much smaller.
Yeah, but is it centralized? Head Start's successful because each community develops their own program.
Yeah. In Scandinavia, they have a universal access program, and I had a chance to live in Norway for a while right before I started medical school. That was one of my projects I used to study that system, and now that's been a number of years. But in maintaining relationships over there, some of the key differences from some of the other programs mentioned is that they do have a program that's paid in part by the government through tax dollars, in large measure by employers, and by the remainder by individual family insurance premiums. They have a centralized system, but the government unit actually sets regulations whereby private insurers then run the program throughout the country. And good private insurers can make some income on following those regulations, can stay in business, and those that can't won't stay in business or won't be in the market. Another feature of that program that's important is that there is a copay. When you go to see your family doctor, you hand them 60 kroner, which is about 9-10 bucks. But you have some individual responsibility that turns the key for your use of the system. It's not free. Okay. There are problems identified with the system, again, are one of waiting. Elective surgeries for gallbladder operation that should come out, but doesn't have to come out today unless it gets infected, is up to a year to 2 years sometimes. Coronary artery bypasses, several years. In Sweden now, they've introduced a two-tiered system that I think a number of the European nations are headed towards. And that's that, as I mentioned before, a guaranteed minimum program. Here's kind of your basic Chevy package of healthcare. These are the things you can get for this copay, and you will get them. You may have to wait, but you will get them. And everyone can have it. If you'd like to have that third opinion, if you'd like your surgery right now, or if you'd like to have a CAT scan instead of waiting to see if your headache's still there in a month, you can have that too if you choose to pay for it with your own money or private insurance money. But everyone will have this basic plan because this is the plan that we as a nation feel everyone should have, and we as a nation can afford it. Mm-hmm. I'd like to see us head toward the two-tier system. I'd like to see it be centrally controlled but locally administered. And I'd like to make sure that we have individual responsibility for accessing the system, even if it's just $5.
Interesting.
I have a question.
Yes.
You know, you talked about student coming out of medical school with a $50,000 debt that's got to be repaid. I think a lot of college students come out of college way in debt. Has there been any talk of making medical school less costly so that there's not that?
Not that I'm aware of.
The opposite direction in Minnesota, what the legislature did to try and hold their costs down was to save it for graduate professional